Hi folks, Barry here. Just before you listen to this week's episode of Worst Foot Forward with Ben and myself, a couple of quick thank yous to a couple of new Patreon donors who've joined us this week in Patreon land. Thank you to Marie Henwood for your donation. You'll be receiving the super secret extra content that our Patreon donors get monthly. And to Caroline Higgins, thank you as well for pledging a little bit more. You'll be getting that secret content as well. But you'll also be suggesting a topic to us, which Ben and I will be covering in a future episode. We've been working our way through those for our various patrons, and so we will be in touch asking you, Caroline, what your topic will be. So thank you to both Marie and Caroline, and indeed to all those people who sponsor us on Patreon. If you are one of those, we are so grateful, and we hope you are continuing to enjoy the extra little benefits being a Patreon donor earns you. And if you're not a person who donates on Patreon but feels like that might be your calling all of a sudden, well, visit patreon.com/worstfootforward and see the various benefits and bonuses that we offer on there. If you go and check on there, we've got a couple of goals at the moment. If we get to 40 patrons, which is only 8 patrons away, we pledge to put on a live show with some special guests from our favourite episodes joining us. And if we get to 50 patrons, the next step along, we will start working on the book containing all of the facts and things that we've learnt on the show that we really love. And we'll also throw a dinner party based on the Futurist's cookbook, which we covered in a recent episode, and we'll invite 4 lucky Patreon donors to join us at that as well. Beyond that, I think when you hit 75, we'll start making some video content, and when we hit 100, we're just going to do a full, you know, tour of the show. So if you want to inflict that on yourselves, and indeed on us, then pop along to Patreon and help us out. What else? This is the last episode we recorded about a month ago, before Ben went off to the Edinburgh Festival. Thank you on Ben's behalf to those people who came along to see the show who are podcast listeners. And also, it's the first episode before schools start going back in September. And so maybe make it your September back-to-school resolution to recommend us to a friend. So if you're talking to someone about your favourite show that you listen to on your commute when you drop the kids to school or afterwards when you're heading to work, why not recommend Worst Foot Forward to them? What's the worst that could happen? You know, that's basically the theme of this show. So thank you very much for listening and enjoy the upcoming hearty shenanigans with Ben and I, including this really odd cold open.
The Antichrist is in the White House. And I'm...
that's the intro to the show, just that sentence.
Yeah. Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Worst Foot Forward, the podcast where each week we celebrate the best of the worst. I'm Ben van der Velde, and this week we're going to do the exact opposite of our brief and talk about some of the best things in the world to try and brighten your perspective and distract you from a planet gone temporarily mad. However, because we live in dark times, 2 of the things we're going to be talking about are our favourite horror movies and the best ever serial killer. So if you can hear something in the background, that's our whirring moral compasses going at 90 miles an hour. And sat opposite me as we record in sweltering heat yet remain bafflingly in the United Kingdom is the man who puts the stay in unexpected staycation. It's Barry McStay.
Yeah, so we've done a few of these now. I think this is the 6th one.
Yes, it is.
We've gone back to sort of a batch of 5 previous episodes. And wow, episodes 26 to 30 have some nebulous subjects in them, don't they? Best serial killer, best horror movie, best driver.
Yeah, best musical duo, yeah. And...
best alien. Yeah. So it's a real mixed bag for you there, folks.
Yeah, it is. But this is sort of a placeholder summer holidays episode.
Yeah, it's definitely last day of term, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. Me and Barry are drawing over each other's shirts and throwing water balloons at any passing staff that we can see.
Yeah, exactly. Should we dive right into serial killers?
Let's dive right into serial killers.
Yeah, in episode 26, we recorded with Kiri Pritchard-McLean of the podcast All Killer No Filler. I think we picked Thomas Quick as the world's worst serial killer.
He was the Swedish guy, wasn't he?
Yes, who was a guy who confessed to lots of crimes and then didn't actually commit any of them.
Yeah.
He had just, you know, been slightly drugged up and reading a lot of suggestive articles in his library and things like that.
Yeah, really important lesson to be learned there from Thomas Quick. If you're going to do something, commit.
Yes. that's it when it comes to serial killers. Some once-off murderers just not committed enough.
Yeah.
What did you find as a...
I found one person who I think we forgot about when we spoke about it originally for the world's worst. Leonardo Gianciulli was operating in Italy in 1939-1940, clearly thinking, there's a war on, no one will notice if there are a few extra bodies. She murdered several women there. Her murder spree started after a visit from a fortune teller left her convinced that she had to perform human sacrifices to keep her son alive.
Wow, was he off at war?
I presume so, yeah.
Wow.
She murdered three women, and to get rid of their bodies, she turned them into soap and tea cakes, which she then sold to her friends.
Oh, wow. As little gifts. Oh, man, that is... it is nice to see a female serial killer just breaking that glass ceiling.
Yeah, exactly. Breaking the glass ceiling with someone's head that she slams against it. Because I went back and looked at some of the list of serial killers, and there's a lot more necrophilia and cannibalism than I think we initially looked at. So
it's really hard to Google the phrase best serial. If you Google the word serial killer in any context, the internet just like expands beyond any sort of sense of possibility. It just seems like there's hundreds and hundreds of... We're fascinated by them.
We are. Well, it's because I think we can imagine and comprehend crimes that are at the boundaries of human behaviour. I mean, I can imagine stealing. I can imagine... murder, I'd rather not, but I can imagine doing it. But serial killer seems so beyond the bounds of human behaviour.
Yeah.
But we're the same species as them, and are they mentally ill? Are they not mentally ill? Most of the time, absolutely.
Yeah.
So I think we're fascinated by that. But the nice thing with Leonardo Gianciulli is that she turned her serial killing into a cottage industry.
Yes, that's true.
But the guy who I think is the best one, I put in a very clever phrase to Google. I put in real... life Dexter. Obviously, Dexter, very famously the American fictional serial killer, who is the serial killer with a heart. That's not a particularly helpful phrase.
His own heart.
Who only kills people who are also serial killers.
Yeah, and does he help the police solve some of the crimes as well?
He works in the police as a blood spatter specialist. It is initially fun, then it has John Lithgow in it as a terrifying bad guy, and then it becomes very implausible. Sorry, it goes from implausible to very implausible.
Yeah.
But I found out about a Brazilian gentleman called Pedro Rodriguez Filho. He picked up the name Pedrinho Matador, or Killer Petey. And he was convicted of killing at least 70 people. And he has said in news reports, he felt the urge to kill at the age of 13 during a fight with an older cousin. But it wasn't until a year later that he followed through on that urge. He murdered the vice mayor of Alfenas in southern Brazil because he fired his father, who he accused of stealing. Now, I'll level with you, that is probably the least forgivable of the crimes that he did.
Yeah.
He went on to murder a guard who was thought to be the actual thief. Now, again, he's being a bit judge, jury and executioner there, but you've got to say, for a psychopath, there's a moral compass there. He moved to Sao Paulo, where he continued his behaviour, murdering a local drug dealer. It was there that he met Maria Aparecida Olimpia, who lived with him for a short while as his lover. She was murdered by gang members, so Filho took it upon himself to avenge her death, murdering and torturing a number of people in an effort to find the identity of the killer.
Right.
By the time he was 18, he'd allegedly killed...
He's not 18 at this point? Oh my God.
Listen, it's like footballers in that part of the world. They start them young, they've got a great youth system. He was doing the serial killer version of futsal. Gets pretty depressing now. His father killed his mother.
Oh.
So Filho reportedly visited him in a local prison and killed him too.
This is the father on whose behalf he killed that mayor a while ago.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
It is
That's like the Godfather Part 3. Like, they've come back in themselves.
He's reported that he cut out a piece of his father's heart and chewed it before spitting it out.
Oof.
To show his retribution. He was finally arrested on the 24th of May 1973... when he was arrested, he was placed in a police car with two other criminals, including a rapist. When the police opened the car door at the other end, they found that Rodriguez had killed the rapist.
Oh, Fucking hell.
Yeah. Since he's been put in prison, he has killed 47 of his fellow inmates, the majority of which are murderers who he believe deserve retribution.
How has he not been, like, locked in solitary? This is just, like, a Brazilian, like, can't wait to combat prison overcrowding. Yeah. Yeah, we just leave it. We have an open door policy for old Rodrigo.
Yeah. So what? Here's the scariest thing. So he was initially sentenced for 128 years in prison, but because he committed crimes while in jail, his sentence was upped to 400 years. But by Brazilian law, the maximum prison sentence is 30 years. So in 2007, he was released.
No. And?
As far as I know, he has not killed anyone since.
Good night, children. Wow. Okay. Pedro Rodrigo Filho.
Yeah.
I went down a similar route to our original choice, Thomas Quick, because the reason we picked him as a terrible serial killer was he was a, you know, he wasn't a serial killer. We considered him to be a serial killer. So I've gone for a guy, for my best serial killer, I've gone for a guy who definitely killed people, but has a similar sort of backstory to Thomas Quick.
Okay.
This is Henry Lee Lucas. He was born in 1936. He died in 2001. And he definitely killed people. He had a very tough upbringing. His father died when he was quite young. His mother was a prostitute who used to make him watch her have sex with her clients and things like that. So very, very, like, rough upbringing. He claimed to have committed his first murder in 1951 when he strangled 17-year-old Laura Burnsley, who had refused to have sex with him. He did later retract that. He did time in jail for burglary. He killed his mother and got sentenced to 20 to 40 years in prison, but got out after 10 because of prison overcrowding. Moved to Florida, and he became friends with a guy called Otis Toole and Toole's niece, Frida, Becky Powell. Later on, he sort of ran away with her, and they lived on the road. And they got to California, and they were employed by someone to look after 82-year-old Kate Rich of Ringgold in Texas.
Mm-hmm.
As they were looking after, and then they were fired, and Powell, the young girl, and this old woman were both murdered. And Lucas, of course, was the prime suspect in the killing. And in 1983, he was arrested for possession of firearms by a Texas Ranger. And Lucas said he was bullied in prison and he attempted suicide. And the police stripped him naked and, you know, beat him up and held him in a coal cell. Really abused him. But after 4 days, he confessed to the murders and brought police to the place where the bodies were. So, you know, fair enough. However, he also started confessing to a lot of other murders. But because he'd started out with a definite confession, because okay, he, you know, he'd found these two bodies and said, this is where they are, and he knew all the details, it gave him so much credibility. They set up the Lucas Task Force because they were able to corroborate something like 28 unsolved murders. He kept, like, making all of these claims. And because of all these confessions, the task force eventually cleared 213 unsolved murders. And in return for this, Lucas was getting preferential treatment. He would be taken out to cafes. Apparently, he was even allowed to read, like, criminal reports. He was rarely handcuffed. He knew the codes for security doors. Like, they were so lax with this fucker. But the problem was, he was really observant. Apparently, on one occasion, he correctly identified a victim in a group photograph because she was wearing spectacles, and he'd seen photo of the crime scene with some glasses on the table in it. So he, like, had put two and two together and thought, okay, she'd be the one wearing the glasses in this photo. He initially, you know, admitted to having killed about 60 people, then raised it to 100. By the time it got to 3,000, he sort of thought maybe he's making it up. But it did take a journalist called Hugh Ainsworth at the Dallas Times Herald, who investigated all of his claims, to really crack the story. They calculated that Lucas would have had to use his 13-year-old Ford station wagon to cover 11,000 miles in 1 month to commit all of the crimes that he said he committed. The Attorney General of the US, Jim Mattox, said that when Lucas was confessing to hundreds of murders, those with custody of Lucas did nothing to bring an end to this hoax. And we have found information that would lead us to believe that some officials cleared cases just to get them off the books. I don't know. It's really hard to pick a best serial killer, but I'm just putting him forward as someone who, you know, definitely serial killer, killed a few people, but also didn't kill 3,000 like he said he did. So, you know, swings and roundabouts.
So what you're saying is that he was the equivalent of a serial killer working under Stalin's five-year plans.
Yes. If that doesn't recommend him to you, I don't know what will. So we've got Henry Lee Lucas or Pedro Rodrigo Filho.
I mean, one little addendum to Pedro's life that I just found out here. As I said, he was released from prison in 2007. Since then, he worked as a caretaker, which is the creepiest job he could have picked.
Yeah.
But he has converted to Christianity.
Uh-huh.
He's writing an autobiography.
Lovely.
He's got a YouTube channel where he gives advice to young people.
Right.
And he lives a completely different life and has spent all his time trying to get young people away from crime.
That sounds really good. You know what? Let's go with Pedro Rodrigo Filho as the world's best serial killer. Yeah. The real life Dexter who, you know, done good.
Eventually.
Eventually. Next up, we did The World's Worst Driver with Dana Alexander, and I think we picked Leopold Leuka, who was the driver for Archduke Franz Ferdinand.
Oh, yeah.
Through the streets of Sarajevo, taking the wrong turn, which led to the assassins getting a second bite at that geopolitical cherry. I looked at stunt drivers.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. Have you seen The Man with the Golden Gun?
Yeah, movie. That's the one where they do the corkscrew flip.
The corkscrew flip. The first barrel roll in cinema history. That.
Really?
Yeah.
I thought that the Dukes of Hazzard would have done something
Dukes
like
that. Dukes of Hazzard came a bit later. Dukes of Hazzard started. I looked this up. Dukes of Hazzard started in 1979.
Oh, wow.
And Man with the Golden Gun is a bit earlier than that. So if people haven't seen it, the clip is online. It's Bond is trying to get somewhere quite quickly and the bridge is miles away and he's in the car with this fat American sheriff sort of figure. Who's adding a sort of a dash of Boss Hogg to reference the Dukes of Hazzard again. Bond sees that there's this old bridge which is missing the middle of the bridge, and one half of it sort of goes up and curves slightly, and the other half is the other half of the corkscrew. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, he drives into some fields, does a reverse foot to the floor, drives over it, one take.
Really?
Done in one take. So this is, as I said, the first barrel roll in cinema history, launched over a river from one angled bridge to another. Even in the 70s, they mapped it out on computers in advance.
Huh.
Like, and the stunt driver who'd been hired to perform it had to fly back to America for family reasons. So they got a mechanic called Lauren Williams, whose nickname was Bump, to do it instead. He had never, ever, ever tried this before. He wasn't a stunt driver. And with no real prep, 8 cameras rolling, ambulances stood at the ready, he drove a 1970s... AMC Hornet, not the best car in the world, up and over this ramp and nails it. If you watch the clip, it is beautiful. Bond producer Cubby Broccoli saw it because he was there for the filming. He ran over to him with a roll of $100 bills as a bonus for nailing it. And Bumps apparently said, "Can we do it again?"
I love oldie worldie stories like this. Like, I know health and safety is important, and I know workplace safety is important, but that's glorious.
Yeah, the only problem with the clip, of course, is that someone genuinely decided to put a slide whistle over the roll.
Yeah.
It's such a terrible editing choice. But I did, in my own head, remember the flip that they do in Casino Royale with the Aston Martin?
Oh, I don't.
So when Bond is leaving the casino and when Vesper's been kidnapped and he's chasing her in the car towards the end, and then the car flips.
Oh, because Vesper's been kidnapped and is in the middle of the road. Yes.
Yeah. That's a stunning bit of stunt driving. So in 2006, they're relaunching Bond with Daniel Craig, and they get Aston Martin are on board, and they want to do this big role with the car. They got some BMW 5 Series cars just to practice with, first of all. And then Aston Martin supplied some pre-production cars to Adam Curley, who was the stunt driver for this particular stunt. Set him up at Millbrook, which is the proving ground, to film it. The only problem was, and what brilliant PR for Aston Martin this was, the Aston Martin DBS just would not roll. It would crash, yeah, absolutely. We had to hit this ramp at 110 kilometres an hour, and then it was downhill after that. So obviously it would crash, but it just wouldn't roll over and put its belly in the air. Great stability, but not great for a movie stunt. And so they tried a couple of times, and they're like, okay, we need to go old school. They went back to proper practical effects, and they got a gas cannon. And he would have to hit a ramp just wide enough for the car, Adam Curley this is, hit the ramp, set off a pressurised gas-powered battering ram with his foot in the base of the car to flip the car up into the air. And if you got it wrong, obviously he'd end up probably somewhere, you know, up a tree or in a river or something like that. It had to be split second time. This just set this cannon off. It would drop a ram through the bottom of the car and make it flip. And he, again, absolutely timed it to perfection. Hit it so fast, 1,500 kilograms of car underneath them, 7 barrel rolls, one more than had ever been seen before.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's amazing. And Curly, obviously, with this world record and the scene in the can, came out and said, that was a fairly violent ride.
Good. That's a much more honest approach to that.
Yeah. But obviously, he had the benefit of some years of experience and all of that technology and everything. I definitely want to recommend Lauren Bumps Williams, though.
Yeah. He is going to blow my suggestions out the water, but just for completeness, I will mention them. So I learned something much more prosaic. I looked at the Guinness World Record for the longest driven journey. And this is a couple called Emil and Liliana Schmidt from Switzerland.
It wasn't that long, but they just didn't get on.
Yeah. No, it is still ongoing. It's a never-ending journey. On 18th of October 1984, they took their Toyota Land Cruiser and they left Switzerland. Mm. And since then, they have been driving around the world. They have visited 180 countries and travelled, as of 2014... 430,130 miles.
Wow.
I'm assuming that doesn't include the shipping across the ocean back and forth.
Yeah, of course.
But they have visited 6 major continents. Mm-hmm. The Land Cruiser has been their home for the past 3 decades.
They haven't replaced the car.
Yeah.
Wow.
Just imagine the stink in there. They fitted it with a 5-pound propane tank, a jerry can for water, and a makeshift bed. They carry a whole bunch of gear with them to share their epic journey, but that's it. And they are with every new mile they drive, they are breaking further into the world record books.
Record, yeah.
But then I thought, listen, particularly on the hottest day of the year that we're recording on, what they're doing is not good for global warming.
Yeah.
So I then looked at what is the world's longest electric car trip. And that is by a chap from the Netherlands called Wiebe Wacker.
17 miles.
How long do you really think it is?
Longest electric car. Let's say he's driven in Asia. 11,000 miles.
59,000 miles.
Ooh.
From Amsterdam to Sydney, Australia. He set out on March 15th, 2016 in a modified VW Golf. He travelled through 33 different countries and with the help of volunteers and some sponsors.
Presumably not all of those countries have lots of charge points.
Yeah, which is... So possibly he had charge points going with him,
yeah.
or charge points were, like, bust in.
Yes.
Awful verb to use in that circumstance. But to put it in perspective, an unmodified Golf would have required about just under 1,800 gallons of fuel. It would have cost just over $4,500, according to American gas prices. He only spent $300 on electricity over 3 years.
That's pretty good.
And most of that was in the Australian outback.
Yeah, yeah.
I think I'm going to choose him just because it is a heartening picture of the future. That's going to be my choice for it. But there is no way that Lauren...
Bumps Williams. Yeah, Lauren Bumps Williams.
Lauren Bumps Williams. Do you reckon he had that nickname before or after he did the stunt?
Well, presumably before, because he landed it perfectly without a single bump. Yeah, great. I'm sure he'll be delighted for this long overdue recognition. Next up, we did the world's worst musical duo with musical duo Johnny and the Baptists, mm-hmm. Johnny and Paddy. And we picked our old friends Daphne and Celeste.
Yeah.
Absolute legends that they are.
Yes, we've learned our lesson from trying to badmouth Daphne and Celeste online. Not badmouth them, but just recount a rather insalubrious time in their performing lives.
Yeah.
But anyway, world's best musical duo, Lennon and McCartney.
I knew you
done.
Were going to say it. Looked up how they met. Do you know how they met?
Lennon and McCartney, they met at a church fete John was playing the guitar and Paul came along and chatted to him there.
They were playing at the Quarrymen, the band was playing there.
Yeah.
And they were taught each other how to tune guitar or something. But that was on July 6, 1957 at St. Peter's Church in Walton in Liverpool.
Yes, it was.
And someone recorded it. No, someone was way. There and recorded the Quarrymen set the day that John Lennon met Paul McCartney. The tape was sold at Sotheby's and it made £78,500.
But it's not been publicly released. It's not on any of the anthologies, I don't think.
No, yeah, I don't think it is. It's just, you know, a really made much more valuable by the day it happened to be recorded on, I guess.
Well, by the fact that, that's like the recording the first time Louis Armstrong picked up a trumpet.
Yeah. Amazing, isn't it?
That's the ultimate year zero in British music.
Yeah. So what's so good about Lennon and McCartney, Ben? Why not Harrison and Starr?
God, can you imagine? That, I mean, that's very much like attaching a ball and chain to George Harrison's legs. Much as I love you, Ringo.
Yeah.
I will love you. It was very hard for me not to go with my second choice, which is the Proclaimers. No, genuinely, the Proclaimers are wonderful. Like, the problem they've got is that they've got 500 miles as a albatross around their neck that follows them everywhere, which, yeah, it's a good, fun foot stomper, but they've written so many beautiful songs. Like, Sunshine on Leith is a real tearjerker, and Over and Done With as well is great. And if you want to watch a great musical movie, watch, I think it's called Sunshine on Leith, the Proclaimers movie.
Is there a Proclaimers movie?
Yeah, well, it's not an autobiography. They've taken their songs and they've plugged them into a plot.
Oh, cool.
It was directed by Dexter Fletcher.
Oh, cool.
Who did Rocketman recently. So the only reason I didn't pick them is because they're not the fucking Beatles. And because I'm still working my way through their back catalogue.
You haven't hit the bumpy patch yet.
I'm sure there is one, but I can't... Genuinely, I can't find it. And because they're brothers, their voice harmonised so beautifully together. But Lennon and McCartney, I know they're not technically a musical duo because they were part of a combo, but they were the driving force of that band and they were the driving force of the greatest musical patch of creativity in history.
Yeah.
Obviously, people like James Brown and Bowie and Prince and Elton John are remarkable solo artists.
Yeah.
But these two were such a perfect match for each other. And the way that in the early years, Lennon was the driving force, and when he had a mental breakdown and took too many drugs, Paul came through. But Paul was cheery, chirpy, major key, a little bit dewy-eyed, a little bit romantic, whereas John was cynical and lyrically barbed and rough-voiced and moody.
Yeah, they challenged each other in just the right way.
Yeah, well, and there's a lovely thing, if you know, they in the early days, they would literally turn up, well, either in a hotel room when they were still touring, they'd be like, right, what you got? Oh, I've got this. Oh, brilliant, well, I know how to finish that off for the middle eight. It was like songwriting tennis. It was beautiful.
Yeah.
My favourite version of them doing that is A Day in the Life,
which
is an incredible piece of music with John sort of wearisome pianos and the lyrics are all bits of cuttings of newspapers. Read the news today, old boy, about a man who didn't make the grade. It was about the son of a lord who killed himself in a car crash.
Oh, right.
And then the 4,000 holes in Blackburn, Lancashire, were just 4,000 potholes that reported in the paper.
We're at art school, yeah. It sounds like an art project, just a collage thing.
Yeah, it is. Well, it's the same way that Bowie would write songs. Bowie famously had the cut-up technique where he just write lyrics, cut them up, and then put them all together in a different way.
Yeah.
And then you've got McCartney's, as soon as the alarm bell goes off, the woke up, got out of bed, dragged comb across my head. And it's such a beautiful mirror image of the two performers. And this is the thing I don't fully understand because I'm not musically trained enough. The way they created harmonies with their voices.
Yeah.
They found harmonic combinations that no one else had ever thought of. It was like they took, you know, the likes of the Everly Brothers and went, hold my beer, Everly Brothers. So I probably, if there are any Beatles fans listening, if there are any Beatles fanatics listening, I have maybe not provided the most evidence for it.
No, because we'd be here all fucking day if you did.
Precisely. So I've made as succinct a point as I can that the commonly held greatest pair of songwriters in British musical history are indeed the greatest musical duo of all time. Off you go.
Sonny and Cher.
No. Move on.
No, I'm obviously going to pick Lennon and McCartney as well. But I did read about early years of some other musical duo. Sonny and Cher's original name. Do you know what it is?
I don't.
Caesar and Cleo.
Yes. Yes,
it was great. And Simon and Garfunkel.
Was it Garfunkel and Garfunkel?
No, it was Tom and Jerry. Yeah.
Damn, I did know that as well.
I did read a bit more about Simon Garfunkel, because I do love Simon and Garfunkel. I mean, talk about creating harmonies and voices, and I don't think there's any better combo in history, just in turn, from that aspect alone. Obviously, famously didn't get on, as many of these musical duos don't seem to. But I read some interesting bits of trivia about it. You know the way that Garfunkel sings Bridge Over Troubled Water?
Yeah.
So many people think he wrote it, and he really didn't. It was Simon. And apparently that was one of the reasons that they broke up, is that Simon just got really pissed off at people assuming that Art wrote Bridge Over Troubled Water, which they then got, like, I think a Grammy for the next year, by which point they had already broken up. And it's quite ironic that a Bridge Over Troubled Water is the the catalyst for that particular breakup, that rift.
I heard a wonderful story about them recently, about when it was the Sound of Silence that broke them as artists.
Yes, it did. And they'd been performing together for like a decade at that point. They'd been around a long time.
And because it's the early 60s and there's no social media, and they're in their own little bubble, so they were living, I think it was at Paul Simon's mother's house.
Yeah.
So they'd been touring, they're back at the mum's house, we're going to have a cigarette, right, we can go outside and smoke it. Go into the car, they have a cigarette, they turn on the radio and they hear the Sound of Silence. And then the DJ goes, "That's the Sound of Silence, ladies and gentlemen, by Simon and Garfunkel, the number one record in America today." And apparently Art Garfunkel turned to Paul Simon and went, "Well, those guys must be having a whale of a time right now."
That's really good. Yeah, that was in 1966, Sound of Silence came out. But they met each other at the age of 11 in school, and they'd been singing together since they were 12. Their first release, I think, this Tom and Jerry act, that came out when they were 18. So they'd been grafting for a long old time. I really liked the fact that, do you know what the, obviously the Mrs. Robinson is their second number one hit from The Graduate. Do you know what the song was originally called?
I don't.
Mrs. Roosevelt.
Huh.
Yeah, when he originally wrote it, he called it Mrs. Roosevelt, and then for the film, when they asked him to write the music for it, he changed the name for it to make it fit. Paul Simon was married to Carrie Fisher.
Yeah?
Yeah, I feel like that's a piece of information I did know, and then had somehow, like, forgotten. Because I read that yesterday, and I was like, really? Yeah, they were dating for, like, pretty much the entire time she was doing Star Wars. And then they got married briefly, and then they divorced, and then they kept dating after their divorce for a bit as well.
She seems a bit too fiery for Paul Simon. I always think of him as a very sort of philosophical and meditative kind of guy.
Yeah, well, she also, in the midst of all of that, was engaged to Dan Aykroyd of another musical duo, the Blues Brothers, in the midst of all of that as well. So she clearly had a thing for half of musical acts. Moved on to the Pet Shop Boys. Yes. Seriously disappointed.
Yeah. She wanted to be a Yoko, just a wandering Yoko.
Yes, yeah. It's much easier to break them up when there's only one person you need to turn against him. But obviously, I think we are going to pick Lennon and McCartney. That was the first thing I wrote down. I just wrote down Lennon McCartney and then just, like, wrote Ben brackets afterwards.
I'm glad that I'm suitably predictable.
Yeah. Our next episode, we did World's Worst Alien with Eric Lampere, and congratulations, guys, because you won. We picked humans. I read some fun facts about aliens. William Herschel, the astronomer in the 1870s, he predicted that Martians on Mars would be taller than humans.
Because of the lack of gravity?
Yeah, Mars is smaller than ours, lower gravity, and he said that Martians would grow taller because they wouldn't be hemmed down by gravity in quite the same way.
I don't know, is that good science?
I don't know.
Yeah, I would like to know what his sister, Caroline Herschel, who at the time was not really well vaunted. We see her as a co-worker. William Herschel definitely won't have done, but I'd like to know what Caroline thought of that.
She's like, yes, William, all right. Yeah. I'll keep doing the writing, you do the front of house stuff.
Yeah.
Immanuel Kant claimed that extraterrestrial intelligence was proportional to however far away from the sun you lived. So he suggests that people who lived on Mercury would be idiots and people who lived on Saturn would be really clever.
I mean, I love the theory.
That's great. But I mean, where does that put us in terms of humans? We're like, what are we, third from the sun?
That seems about right, doesn't
it? Yeah, we say just about average. We're a sort of a C+, maybe. And in 1848, the Scottish Church Minister Thomas Dick tried to calculate the number of aliens living in the solar system. But he based it on how many people lived in England. 280 people per square mile. So he just applied that to the solar system and estimated there were 22 trillion inhabitants. Don't you love Victorian scientists? Church minister and science teacher.
I don't get how you can be so clever and so dumb at the same time. Also, did he finish off? There's 22 trillion people in the universe, so put up the borders.
Yeah.
We're full.
Coming over here. But I loved, this is just me and you probably hate it, but I loved Alf so much. The title character of the sitcom Alf from the 80s.
Standing for alien life form.
Yeah, it is. Do you know what his real name is?
No.
Gordon Shumway.
I'm a big fan.
Yeah, and he's so sarcastic. I think because I was watching it as a kid, I think I was watching it in, you know, not in real time, but like at the time it was first broadcast, and I was only 4 or 5. But obviously, puppets, big selling point. Puppet alien, great. The fact that he eats cats, hilarious. and the sarcasm was, I think that sort of has affected my humor right to this day. The basic premise is that he's an alien who's crash landed on Earth. And he sort of ends up moving in with the suburban middle-class Tanner family. The character was created by Paul Fusco, who was a puppeteer. And he was originally auditioned by some producer who I think was a bit dubious. Because, you know, Jim Henson was still alive and the Muppets and Jim Henson's work was considered like the leading puppeteer.
Yeah, and I didn't realise that it's not part of the Henson
universe.
Yes.
Yeah, the expanded Henson universe. No, he was outside of it. And but his act was so funny that the producer thought, oh yeah, we can get a series out of this. And it ran for 4 series. In fact, they made 99 episodes. A couple of them were split into 2 half hours for syndication. And then when it was cancelled after the 4th series and was cancelled with a sort of a cliffhanger and a to be continued, they actually tied it up in the mid-90s with a TV movie. And the way it was made, they had a set that was like 4 foot up off the ground and trap doors all over it for Alf to be able to pop up here and there, which seems like a death trap for actual actors. It has a laugh track, but there's no live audience. Because it took them like 20 hours to record what was just a half hour sitcom because of all the technical things, because it would be 2 puppeteers, sometimes 3, very sort of dexterous movements for Alf as well. And to avoid the wear and tear on the principal Alf puppet, the performers sometimes rehearsed with Ralph, rehearsal alien life form.
I mean, I'll level with you. If we're going to stick a little bit to this show's guns, then Ralph should be the best alien
yeah,
in the
he
world.
Yeah, really should, as the stand-in. Apparently, there was quite a bad atmosphere on set. A lot of the cast members have said they had a really horrible time. Max Wright, who played the dad, said he despised supporting a technically demanding inanimate object that received most of the good lines of dialogue.
I know how he feels.
Yeah. He admitted to being hugely eager to have Alf over with. There was a report that actually Max Wright became so crazed and attacked Alf one time during a shoot. They had to be pulled off the puppet. And that you can watch outtakes from it, and he does seem to be slightly joyless when he's around the puppet. It's a slightly tense atmosphere. But some of the things I love about it are, Paul Fusco said that the greatest things were the jokes they couldn't put into the show. So they had things with Alf eating cats in the first series, which they weaned out after the first series because NBC reported that a child placed a cat in a microwave after watching the show. Although there are the occasional references at an episode at a wedding, Alf references how they used to have a wedding cat on his planet of Melmac instead of wedding cake. In the pilot episode, he drinks beer. Fusco defended that, saying, you know, Alf is 285 years old, he can drink beer if he wants, but became very popular with children, so NBC said they couldn't have him drinking. They had an hour-long episode in season 1 called Try to Remember. When Alf gets amnesia, he tries to simulate a jacuzzi by bringing an electric mixer into the bath with him, gets an electric shock and causes amnesia. And at the end of the episode, they had a public service announcement from Alf warning of the dangers of mixing water and electricity. Despite that, NBC reported that the child did try to recreate this and nearly electrocuted himself. The child was unharmed, but Fusco was forced to film the sequence again, replacing the electric mixer with an egg beater, and instead Alf sort of slips and bangs his head on the side of the bath or something instead. They overdubbed the zap sound with a thud sound, and they take out the public service announcement bit at the end as well. And so that's the bit they aired in syndication. I just loved the show, and I think it was one of the first comedy shows I remember watching. And it's such a weird premise, and brilliant, and so 80s, and so sarcastic. And, you know, it sounds like, you know, a difficult but wonderful atmosphere to work in.
Yeah, I mean, it seems he strikes me as being like sort of like George Burns if he was an alien.
yeah.
Oh god, I just remembered what we learned about George Burns about 6 weeks ago.
Yeah.
Let's not go into whether Alf is as well endowed as that.
No, that's Milton Berle you're thinking of.
Do you know what, George Burns? Let's say you've got a long
tongue
as well.
Yeah, you're listening, George. Congratulations on the size of your enormous penis.
He's like, I'm a ghost. It matters not to me now.
Yeah.
I went scientific. Do you know where scientists think that if there is life in this solar system, where it is most likely to be?
Oh, so it's Europa. There's a couple of the moons which have water underneath the surface.
Yeah, so it's Europa, which is one of Jupiter's moons. There is an icy shell around it, which averages out at about 22 kilometres deep.
Mm.
Beneath that, there is an ocean of liquid water, which could be up to 200 kilometres deep.
They suggest the moon may have a warm core like the Earth does, which our moon doesn't, which is why the ocean's there. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. There's some debate as to what kind of gobstopper Europa is.
Yeah.
There's basically two schools of whether it's thin crust, lots of water, or thick crust, and sort of like just little pockets of lakes.
Yeah.
The unexciting version of what they are looking for is for vents around it. The vents will provide the building blocks for life, which are known as abiogenesis, which is liquid water, ideally, some sort of energy source. They can't get the sun, but the heat from the core could be provided. And I didn't fully understand this, but the gravitational pull of Jupiter could also be used, apparently,
for them to be able to grow or something.
Yeah, and then
really tall.
Yeah, and then the right atoms to serve as chemical building blocks. And it has been postulated that these sort of vents, which we can see on Earth and have incredible algae and coral, and I think viper fish is one other thing around them. Lots of sort of like eel and elongated fish. So there's that possibility. That is about as far as respectable scientists have been willing to postulate.
Yeah.
However, some have got a little bit more carried away and have suggested, well, if there are giant oceans, because of this thing called convergent evolution, which they are like, there are only so many ways that you can solve a problem of dealing with your environment. So things like shells and flippers and mandibles and all that sort of stuff could exist. They have postulated in this giant underwater lunar sea, enormous blind whales.
Crashing into each other. Yeah, I know they use sonar. Shut up, nerds.
Yeah. Well, you don't know if moon whales will use sonar.
Exactly. Yeah, it mightn't travel so well.
Yeah.
That's so funny.
So, I
imagine the size of the sticks that they're using to tap around.
Well, no, surely they just use dogfish.
How big are their seeing eye dogfish, yeah? Giant seeing eye dogfish.
Giant seeing eye dogfish, yeah. Well, there's an apparently
chasing giant catfish.
And there's also, like, the whales going after them going, Fenton! A thing that genuinely exists there are like sort of enormous geysers that burst out of the surface.
Danny Dyer. Oh, our geyser.
Yeah, well, I presume it's just two whales crashing into each other and forcing water up out of there. So that's my suggestion.
I love the idea of blind space whales.
Are we going for that?
Let's go with blind space whales.
Yes, mate.
Finally, we talked about the world's worst horror movie with Bisha K. Ali, and I think we picked Plan 9 from Outer Space.
We did.
Bela Lugosi's unwitting final film.
Yeah, just a little shout out to Bisha, who since we last worked with her, has gone on to some fairly impressive surroundings. She's now working in LA and was working with Mindy Kaling on her show, and is currently a writer for Marvel.
Never heard of them.
No, me neither. I just wanted to, you know, she sounds like she needs all the help she can get.
Yeah, absolutely.
My wife loves horror movies. I'm not great at them.
I can't stand them.
The movie that probably scared me the most was Wreck, which I think I might have talked about on the podcast, but it's a bit of a Blair Witchy found footage thing. But it's a Spanish movie set, and it starts off as a documentary where they're just following the Spanish fire brigade around for an evening, and they come to this house where something's happened. And then the doors shut down and the windows shut off and the lights go off and you're all watching it through a Steadicam.
Oh, wow.
And something creepy is happening in the attic. And that made me jump.
Yeah.
But the horror movies that I enjoy are the ones that get into my own head and under my skin. We went to go see Midsommar last week, which is bloody weird.
Yeah.
And that creeped me out for a couple of days. But the original one that creeped me out was The Omen. It's big and it's silly and it's overblown and it's, and I like that it's religious because I'm, you know, grown up in a religious household. Even though I have dismissed most of it, psychologically it can really get into my head. And, you know, the Catholic Church has got some great creepy iconography, not least a poor guy nailed to a cross.
Yeah.
And also that Omen is responsible for the Terry Pratchett and Neil Gaiman book Good Omens, which was my, I think, my entry, certainly to Gaiman, and an early entry to Pratchett.
Yeah.
So if you've not watched it, it's a movie that came out 1976, starring Gregory Peck, lest we forget.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
In the role of...
Of the Omen.
Of the Omen. Yes, an Irish man. Yeah, so Gregory Peck plays the role of Robert Thorne, who is like the American ambassador who ends up with the baby-swapped Antichrist called Damien.
Yeah.
And some of the most shocking scenes in it, and one that really stayed with me. So Damien's nanny turns up to look after him when he's, you know, very young. And then at his fifth birthday party, the nanny climbs out the window, sticks a rope around her neck, shouts out, "Damien, this is for you," and then jumps off and hangs herself.
Ugh.
And there's no blood, there's no gore, there's
no surprise, it's a birthday present.
Yeah.
Should have wrapped herself.
Yeah, when rigor mortis sets in, she'll inflate slightly, like a helium balloon. The most shocking bit is when one of the guys who tries to warn Gregory Peck's character that his son is the Antichrist, and he's a photographer and he finds all these weird lines on the bodies of people that he photographs, and they are premonitions of their death. So there's a priest he's working with as well, and the priest has this line from his shoulder down through his torso, and eventually he dies because a church spire comes off and impales him.
Yeah.
And then the photographer sees a line across his neck and he's like, uh-oh, I'm getting decapitated, aren't I? And he travels to Israel. That's where he finds the original burial site of Damien's mother, which has just the corpse of a jackal in it and the baby that he was swapped with. And he's walking down these stairways in a presumed Jerusalem, and there are men walking ahead of him with some plate glass. And as I remember it, they slip and the plate glass just clean takes his head off.
Yeah, it's like Final Destination.
Just a little bit. And it is. And listen, there is that little, I don't know if it's played for comedy, but it is a little bit funny, but just the... That scene with the nanny really got to me. Oh yeah, and also Damien's mother later on gets pregnant and Damien knocks her down some stairs and she loses the baby.
Oh.
Because Gregory Peck's character is an American ambassador, the final scene is, the penultimate scene, Gregory Peck, who has accepted that his son is the devil because he's seen the mark of 666 on his head, takes him to a church. He has the seven holy knives that he needs to kill him, and the police see him speeding, so they follow him, and they arrive there and they see this man about to stab a boy, and so they shoot him.
Yeah.
And the final scene is Damien at his parents' funeral with the President of the United States there with his hand on his shoulder, and Damien just has this grin on his face because the Antichrist is in the White House. And I'm...
That's the intro to the show, just that sentence.
Yeah. So, it's so preposterous and overblown.
Yeah.
But like the Bible, it freaks me out for those reasons.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
One final...
I suppose the thing is, when plotting is that clever, that it can be overblown,
we'll
go with it. It's like, you know, well-thought-out improv. It could be stupid, but if there's, you know, there seems to be an internal logic to it all, then...
Well, that's it. Yeah, it's because an awful lot of scary horror is very plausible, and that's where it gets you, but this isn't. One last thing about it. The theme song, composed by Jerry Goldsmith, it's called Ave Satani.
Yeah.
And he basically, which literally means Hail Satan, and he took a...
Actually, maybe that's the intro to the show, the two of us going Hail Satan at the same time.
Hello, and also goodbye, some vans. Yeah. But he took a traditional Gregorian chant and changed some of the words to create some sort of black mass. So it includes the lyrics, Sanguinium bibimus, corpus edimus, tole corpus satane, ave ave antichristi, ave satana. We drink the blood, we eat the body, raise the body of Satan. Hail, hail Antichrist. Hail Satan.
I went for a movie that isn't necessarily considered a horror movie.
Okay.
Jaws. Because it's a thriller, but it has maybe the most influential horror trope it maybe coins the most influential horror trope of not showing you the monster.
Yeah.
You don't see, obviously everyone knows the story of Jaws, I guess. Mm-hmm. A great white shark terrorizing Amity Island on the weekend of July the 4th. He's meant to be between 20 and 25 feet long, and you don't see him until 16 minutes and 28 seconds into the film. You get a first partial glimpse, and the first full shot, 76 minutes and 50 seconds.
Yeah, you know why, don't you?
Oh, we know why. By the way, total screen time, only 4 minutes for the shark.
Wow.
And only killed 5, body count. Yeah, everyone knows, I think, that the sharks were an absolute pain to use. I think they had 3 of them, like a half and a full thing, and they were on cranes and on. They had all sorts of internal engines and things, and they kept breaking down. I think Spielberg referred to them as the Great White Turd. The shark was nicknamed Bruce after Spielberg's lawyer, Bruce Raymer. And the main problem was that they were shooting in the ocean rather than in a tank.
Oh, gosh.
Spielberg decided he wanted to go real with this. And he was still very, obviously, in the 70s, very early on. They had 55 days to shoot it, but actually it took over 155 days to do it. They had a lot of trouble with the script, because there are lots of bits of the original book by Peter Benchley that they didn't want to put in, and they want plots changed. He had a few goes at writing it. They brought in some other screenwriters. Eventually, the actor and writer Carl Gottlieb, who's in the film, was rewriting it like the night before. They'd have dinner, him and Spielberg and the other actors, and they'd chat about what might happen. He'd knock up the scene for the next day. And obviously, I think a lot of people know that we're going to need a bigger boat as an improvised line. Well, a lot of the lines are improvised.
Really?
Either from the night before or on set. They had a $4 million budget and it cost $9 million to make it. Robert Shaw used to go over the border to Canada in between shooting for tax reasons. Try to spend as little time in America as possible. So, obviously, a lot of the mechanical delays and things meant Spielberg had to shoot a lot of scenes with the shark only hinted at. For a lot of the shark hunt, its location is just indicated by floating yellow barrels.
Yeah. That's such a clever way of getting around it.
Yeah. At the opening bit had the shark devouring Chrissy, the woman. Mm-hmm. It's rewritten so you just see her being dragged back by cables to simulate it.
Yeah, and she, because she like broke ribs doing that.
Yeah, I think so. And he also, obviously, the dorsal fin is the iconic thing. That, obviously, is really quite scary. Just, again, the partial glimpses. But, again, it was just because the main puppet wasn't working. But it's really, that's really regarded as the adding to the whole suspense. And Spielberg put it himself. This film went from a Japanese Saturday matinee horror flick to more of a Hitchcock, the less you see, the more you get thriller. And in another interview, he said, the shark not working was a godsend. It made me become more like Alfred Hitchcock than like Ray Harryhausen. The acting was crucial because it meant the more fake the shark looked in the water, the more Spielberg's anxiety told him to heighten the naturalism. Just make everyone really, really play the fear. They did use real footage of sharks shot by Ron and Valerie Taylor off the coast of Australia with a short actor in a shark cage to make the sharks look bigger.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the bit of the cage being attacked. A great white shark attacked the boat and the cage during the shoot. And they wanted in the film to have Hooper killed, Richard Dreyfuss' character, but because he wasn't in the cage when they filmed this footage, but the footage looked so cool, Spielberg really wanted to use the footage, so he altered the storyline to have Hooper escape. So it completely saved his character just because this shot of the cage being attacked by a grey white shark, but it didn't have anyone in it, looked so amazing. It was the biggest box office film in the world until Star Wars came along, and adjusted for inflation in 2011 it passed $2 billion in takings, and it is still, adjusting for inflation, the 7th largest box office taking film of all time in North America and in Britain, I think, as well. It won 3 Oscars for editing, sound and score. Of course, John Williams is famous, very minimal, mm-hmm, 2 notes. It lost out on Best Film to One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and Spielberg, still to this day, I imagine, is bitter that he didn't get nominated for Best Director. Probably because he couldn't shoot to schedule.
Yeah. Yeah, sometimes it's the little details that mean you don't get it.
Yeah. What do you reckon, The Omen or Jaws?
I mean, I love with you, we've both gone pretty mainstream,
yeah.
And this is one, I think, listeners, if you're listening to this and you have a favourite horror movie, neither of us are aficionados on this.
Yeah.
So do let us know what we've messed out. I dropped Reckon Midsommar, just to get my art house credentials. You can decide ultimately, but The Omen scares me more than Jaws.
Yeah, I mean, it probably pitches itself more as a horror movie, so let's go with The Omen.
Although Jaws is a phenomenal movie.
So that's it. That's episodes 26 to 30. Revisited, redone. The Jaws 2 of the podcast, if you will. If you've been listening to us throughout the summer or the last year as ever, thank you for doing that. You can find us on social media on Twitter at WorstFoot. We're on Facebook, WorstFoot Forward. You can email us, WorstFootForwardPodcast@gmail.com, or go to our website, WorstFootForwardPodcast.com.
This will be the last episode that we released of August,
which
means that we don't know who next week's guest is going to be, but we can tell you that Ben will have just returned from the Edinburgh Festival and thus will be a broken man.
We're going to need a bigger Ben. Thank you for listening to Worstfoot Forward. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Worst Foot Forward is part of Podnose, the UK's leading independent entertainment podcasting network. For episode archives of Worst Foot Forward and all of the shows on the network, visit us at www.podnose.com. You can also follow us on Twitter via @podnose or send us an email via admin@podnose.com.